as a wheelchair user, like most of the time when I show up in like a dance or choreographic context, I am the only person who moves in the way that I do. And so I guess, you know, coming from that place, it's not a great interest of mine and it's not really part of my reality either to make performance work where everybody looks the same and moves the same way.
Welcome to How to Play in Slow Time, interviews on creativity, where artists pull back the curtain on their creative practices to share how they listen, play, embody, imagine, model, and collaborate towards discovering something new. In this episode, interdisciplinary artist Rihanna Head-Toussaint discusses her choreographic practice. Rihanna explains how her lived experiences of using a wheelchair for mobility has informed her approach to movement and collaboration. She also speaks about paying attention to her surroundings and making with her environment.
My name is Rihanna Head-Toussaint. I am a person who works across a lot of creative contexts. I have I guess you could say like an individual artistic practice. So like I make choreography and video work and performance, but I do that in collaboration with other people as well. And then I also have a curatorial practice, which I guess to me just feels like supporting other people to show their work to the world and creating environments and contexts for that. I also am a DJ and I run an ongoing club night called Crip Rave Theory, which is about drawing on intersectional disabled knowledge to try to create more accessible dance and party spaces. And I guess that's curatorial as well in a way, and it's creative too. It's all creative and curatorial in different ways. And I have a background in law. So I did a law degree. I didn't study or train at any performance or creative institutions. That's what I did at uni. So I guess that underpins or like informs a lot of what I do in terms of the stance that I take around people and their creativity, viewing it as a right, that people should have the right to like access those spaces and modes and also express themselves. I worked at the Human Rights Commission for a while after I finished uni, and that was really amazing in some ways. Like my area of interest and speciality is anti-discrimination and human rights. So that's one of the pinnacle places that you might try to work at if you have that kind of interest and speciality. And I really loved it in a lot of ways and had a lot of amazing opportunities to do different types of work there. Policy work and then working in the investigation and conciliation section, which is about more actively supporting people to resolve individual situations of discrimination. But there were also issues working there, cultural issues in terms of the way that they approached the makeup of teams and the skill sets that they required. I feel like at the time when I was there, there wasn't maybe enough emphasis put on making space for people with relevant lived experiences to actually contribute to the work. And I guess I was frustrated as well because I felt the commission does amazing work, but it doesn't have that many directive powers. So like the ability that it has to compel organisations or individuals to change their practices is pretty limited in a lot of ways. That was part of why I decided to make a change into creative spaces, because I was like, there's a lot of rigidity here, which is just to do with systems and structures. And I think perhaps in creative contexts, I might be able to enact change in ways that feel more tangible and are more accessible to the different communities that I'm part of and engage with. Because, you know, I'm a disabled person, I'm a person of colour, I'm a queer person. So I cross a lot of different intersections, and that, I guess, just means that a lot of systems and structures are not built with me in mind. I'm a wheelchair user, and I have been since I was a little kid. And so I think that had a lot to do with me becoming a creative person because, you know, I'm in my early 30s now. So, like, you know, when I was younger, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, like, things were way more inaccessible than they are now. Not to say that they're great at the moment, but back then, wheelchair accessibility was not nearly as much of a consideration. So there were a lot of places and spaces that I couldn't access as a child. And so I had to be creative and inventive and use my imagination. I did a lot of, like, writing when I was young. I really wanted to be a writer. That's the first thing I ever wanted to do because I wrote a lot of stories or was, like, watching TV shows or, like, movies and stuff that I liked because those were ways that I could create other worlds and other places that I could inhabit. And then, yeah, just being out and navigating the world, I had to learn to be creative around that as well in terms of how I could get to places, what help I might need, you know, what skills I might need to develop, even just from like a physical sense or whatever. Am I going to be able to climb on this play apparatus on my own? What things could we bring there that might make it a bit easier for me to play there? Yeah, I was having to be creative and doing a lot of that from when I was really young. Particular artists don't really jump to mind for me, but I guess my family, like my mum, my grandma, and my uncles who I grew up with, all of them were really instrumental in fostering my creativity, I suppose, because, yeah, they really took the attitude of, you know, whatever you would like to do, like, we're not gonna stop you because it might be difficult or unsure if you'll be able to do it. They were, like, open to me bringing whatever I wanted to engage with to them and then us trying to work out together a way to do that. My two uncles, one of them, he was a welder and another uncle's a surfboard maker, so they had a lot of technical skills. And so they made different attachments for my wheelchair and things like this so that we could do a lot of things and we could access a lot of terrains that maybe you couldn't just in like a standard everyday chair. I feel like they were really instrumental, creative inspirations for me in that way, the openness of their thinking and their willingness to just like give it a go. When I think about choreography, I'm really just thinking about assemblage or like bringing together of different elements to create the conditions for feeling or like encourage people to reflect on things. So that's really broad, but I guess in terms of the things that I like aesthetically, it usually involves people interacting with existing built environments, public places and spaces. And so when I'm making that kind of work, usually I'm really inspired by the place. I'll go to the place and there'll be something about it, whether it's the kind of like forms of the architecture, the feeling that I get there, or it could be like the light, or it could be maybe more of like the political context of the space. Those things are usually what will be the start of my process around choreographic work. Then if it's curating where I'm like bringing together the works of other people and trying to create a context for them to be seen, I'll be thinking about whatever it is, the festival or the gallery or whatever, and trying to think what would be challenging in this space, what would open up people's perspectives, what kind of works and artists haven't been shown here enough and need to be in this space. I ran a choreographic lab, and the reason that I did that was because I felt like I didn't know how to be a choreographer, but I was interested in choreography and wanted to make choreography. But I felt like there was some kind of like strange mystique behind it or something, and I was like, I kind of have ideas about how to do this, but I think maybe I'm doing it wrong. And I had also had like one or two experiences where I had like tried to do things in certain ways that didn't really feel right for me. And so I was like, I think I really, really want to run a lab and just, which is like a workshop, and just have some time working with some people and see if I can get clarified on what I enjoy doing and what other people enjoy doing. And so as part of that lab, the call out that I did was really inviting people who moved in lots of different ways, because you know, as a wheelchair user, like most of the time when I show up in like a dance or choreographic context, I am the only person who moves in the way that I do. And so I guess, you know, coming from that place, it's not a great interest of mine, and it's not really part of my reality either, to like make performance work where everybody looks the same and moves the same way. It's not accessible to me. And so I was like, you know, I want to work with a lot of different types of people because I'm interested in lots of different types of movement together. That's my experience, like moving in a different way to everybody else most of the time who I'm around. So I made the call out really broad, and I like was looking for, you know, people who skateboard, people who ride bikes, people who come from like more of a performance art background, people who are also like who would consider themselves dancers with a capital D. As part of the call out, I was like, I'm also just interested in connecting with people who resonate with different types of terms, and I just like had a list of words like outsider or like anarchy or like different kinds of things that I thought maybe some like-minded people would latch onto and be interested in. And we worked together for those 2 weeks, and then we did a showing, and we'd only been working for a short time, but I felt like aesthetically it was what I wanted. It felt like we had made something that was really meaningful and really fitted with the aesthetic that I kind of wanted instinctively, but had never felt like I could access or utilize or something in the past. I found it affecting what had happened and wanted to do it again. Yeah, we like stayed in touch, and then we made the first iteration of the work. And people loved it. And then we've done it a few times since then. We did it at Casula Powerhouse Arts Centre. There's like some post-industrial ruins at the front, and we performed there. So we performed half of it in that space, climbing on those things, interacting with those things, and then half at the back of the arts centre where there's these disused water tanks. We like worked around them. And then we also have done it at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. And then I've made video versions of all of them as well, so that people, you know, who weren't able to come there in person can still experience the work. Your individuality as a person, the lived experience that you have, the background that you come from, the stuff that you're interested in, that is your special stuff. There's such a mystique that is perpetuated in some ways and makes people feel really inferior, that the ways that they kind of instinctively would like to work are wrong or something, especially if you haven't trained at a traditional institution. Just try to go with what your intuition is telling you, because that is what is exciting and compelling about you. That is what's going to make your work unique. These ways of working with animate loading, Crip Rave theory, this party that I put on, all these things, they come directly from the complexity of my lived experience. And in terms of like the germination of the idea, I mean, obviously I'm working with lots of other people and they're bringing all of their individuality to it as well. But yes, I think just trying to tap into what makes you you creatively, and that your history and everything, even if it feels like it has nothing to do with art or being creative, it can, and it probably does.
This episode is part of a series of interviews with extraordinary people talking about their creative practice. You can find the rest of the series wherever you get your podcasts. You can also purchase our book titled How to Play in Slow Time, which unpacks the theory, practice, and teaching approaches to creativity from Brill Publishers at brill.com. How to Play in Slow Time was created and produced by Charlotte Farrell, Alexandra Talamu, Brioni Trezise, and Maria White. Edited and scored with original music by Tom Hogan. Special thanks goes out to the Technical Resource Centre and the Creative Practice Lab at UNSW Sydney, where our podcast was recorded. UNSW Sydney exists on the lands and waters that have been cared for since time immemorial by the Bidjigal people of the Eora Nation, whose sovereignty has never ceded. I'm Maria White, and we hope you join us on the next episode of How to Play in Slow Time, interviews on creativity.